Welcome to Thinking Out Loud, the podcast that puts you inside conversations with the most deeply passionate, intensely dedicated, and yes, the most thoughtful people in our industry. So sit back and stay tuned. They may just change the way you think.
Hello, I'm Vicki Lins, President and CEO of CTAM, a marketing organization focused on the media, entertainment, tech industry. Today, I'm speaking with John Gegengack, founder and principal of Hub Entertainment Research. John, you launched Hub in 2013, just as the convergence of technology and entertainment began to gain speed. What was it that you saw coming? What need did you identify that led you to start Hub?
Sure. And thanks very much for having me. The reason we started this company is back probably around 2012. At my last job, we were doing consumer research among people that were using all kinds of entertainment content, but especially television. At the same job, companies like eBay and Google and other companies that were using technology to transform industries that have been around for a long time. And in doing some work in the television industry, we realized that really this was an industry that sort of been able to put off other kinds of technological disruption for about 50 years. And as people are carrying around devices in their pockets that had more computing power than any other device that people might have had on a desktop even a few years earlier, it really seemed like that was going to transform the way a truly massive industry worked, something where there could be a lot to be gained by learning as much as we could, as fast as we could, about how technology was going to change the way that people find and choose and watch TV content.
A lot of our listeners are probably not intimately familiar with Hub. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what Hub looks like today?
Sure. So we're a consumer research company, and we only do research on consumer entertainment. So we conduct surveys and do focus groups and do in-home ethnographies to learn everything we can about how people find, choose, and consume and pay for entertainment content. So we publish a bunch of studies on how people are consuming video content, which providers they're using, if they're using paid platforms or using ad-supported, and how new kinds of video content, you know, things we wouldn't necessarily think of as television, but that consumers use it interchangeably, are changing their behavior.
You are viewed as an expert on content consumption and technology influences. So tell us, what do you see changing and where are things headed?
I think you can boil it down to even one sort of overarching trend, and that is that for almost all the time that TV has been around, consumers have been the end user, but they haven't really been the customer. And all of the decision making was in the hands of other companies. And in fact, in many cases, those consumers were actually the product, as their attention is sold to advertisers. And that's why we've seen things where people didn't really have a choice of where to get their TV content from, and they only had a choice of what to watch in as much as whatever was on linear TV at that particular time of day. And what technology has done is really taken consumers and put them in the driver's seat like they are in so many other industries. So they're now not only the end user, but they're also the customer because they can vote with their feet by going to different platforms. And that competition has really transformed TV, the business of it, and the experience of watching it work. And that's a great thing for consumers. And I think it's ultimately a really good thing for the medium of television as it competes with things like social media and video games. But certainly it's a big, very fundamental transformation that we're still going through even now.
There are battles for eyeballs happening in other ways as well. So it isn't just a customer service aspect. It's also a content aspect, right? I think that feeds into this recent study that Hub has just released about the evolution of video branding, I guess, and the importance of how branding of networks and providers and shows impact what viewers choose to watch. Is that a fair encapsulation of the,
for sure,
the data?
Yeah, this is one that we do every year, and I think is really interesting because, like all kinds of consumers, TV consumers also like to have choice. But there's lots of evidence that right now they have so much choice that for them, it's hard to know where to begin. And that drives interest in things like aggregation, which is what cable TV bundles were created to do in the first place. We actually see now that there's so many options, it's kind of driving the pendulum back again towards where we came from.
And so explain that to us a little bit more.
Sure. So in some of our other research, we track the number of providers that each respondent uses to watch TV, and that could include cable, streaming providers, transactional buying of episodes or seasons. And in 2020, that hit an all-time high. So in our survey, the average person was using almost 5 different TV sources, and that was up from about 3 in 2018 and from 3.7 in 2019. And certainly the pandemic drove a lot of that by creating this vacuum that people needed to fill with content of some kind at home. But that was very much a transformation that's been going on for a while. But at the end of the day, for consumers, they're really excited about the number of providers they have to choose from. They're excited about the fact that they can choose whether they want to pay a subscription or they want to pay with their time by watching advertising. And they're really excited about the quality, you know, all these really high budget new originals that are being created by almost every platform. So there's always something good on to watch. But one of the problems is that they really have trouble, especially with all the new standalone services, of telling the difference between them, or knowing why they would want one or instead of another, and especially how to find something they want to watch across all these different platforms. And that's definitely a first world problem to have, but it's one that people talk about.
So how are people discovering new content and deciding what to watch?
A lot of it is from word of mouth. And one really interesting experiment that we did is we asked people to tell us about a new show that they started watching in the last 6 months. And then we asked them to tell us what show it was. And then we asked them, how do you usually watch that? So is it on live TV? Is it on Netflix? Is it on Hulu? Is it on your DVR? And when we sat back to look at all of these things, no matter what the show was, the two most common ways that people heard about it were either from advertising or through some kind of word of mouth, either talking directly to somebody else or someone else emailed them about it, or a person they knew posted something about it or sent them a message on social media. But the big difference was if they said that they watched that show on live TV, advertising was by far the most common way of discovery, and word of mouth was number two, a pretty good distance behind. If they said that they watched that show on a streaming platform, word of mouth was by far the biggest mode of discovery, and advertising was a distant second to that. And that really makes sense. And it also explains why shows can spread so efficiently when they're online. People just hear about them from someone they know and they watch it. They don't have to have a huge marketing campaign pushing them out to people. They just kind of spread on their own the way things tend to spread in general when they're online.
It also raises the bar on the importance of producing content that will really resonate. Yep. And the pressure to sort of have a hit, however you define hit, because if you really are going to live by word of mouth, live by buzz, you sort of need to gain that traction, I would imagine, pretty quickly with the new content you're putting out there.
It does two things. One is it really raises the bar for how good a new show has to be before people will take a chance on it. But the other really big impact it has is it gives content a much longer tail. So people that we talk to, young people that we talk to that are watching Friends, for example, don't really care that it's not a new show. It's just new to them. And that's really kind of the new way that I think people define new content these days, is the newest content is usually charged at a premium or made available at a premium. And consumers still think of it that way to some extent, but there is also this huge ocean of content that is older, but they haven't seen it before. And it's new to them. And it's just as high quality as it was when it was new to everyone. That is just as appealing and something that will pull an audience just as hard as a brand new show that is building an audience for the first time. And the proof of that is if we look back at when Netflix first started. Today, we all think about Netflix and their original shows and all the awards that they're getting. But for the first few years that Netflix was around, it didn't have any new shows at all. The very first one they made was Lilyhammer, which I think was in 2013. But before that, they made a living and were very successful just by packaging up shows that they had licensed from other networks that none of them were new. And in fact, often they were kind of the oldest or the ones that the networks thought they couldn't monetize themselves. But by taking that library and organizing it in a way that was easy to use or even fun to use, lots of lists and images and recommendations, they introduced consumers to this idea that I can find something I'm going to be interested in a big library, even though I haven't necessarily heard of any of these shows before. I can feel confident that there's something in there I'm going to like.
Let's talk a little bit about the importance of program brands, which seem to have escalated in value and impact, versus the importance and role of network or distribution brands, and that dynamic of what the brand means to attracting and or keeping an audience.
It used to be, I think, that show brands and network brands were sort of one and the same, but especially now with licensing to streaming platforms, the show brands move around and people will follow the show brands that they like from place to place. And one thing that this does is that in some cases, the show brands eclipse the brand of whatever network they're on. And that makes them a really good way to draw audience to new platforms. And it's also a risk for the companies that created the show in the first place, that as they license these shows, their association of their network brand with that show is going to be stripped away. So in one study, for example, we asked people if they'd watched any of a set of shows on Netflix. Some of them were, and they were all really popular shows. Some of them were licensed. Some of them were Netflix originals. And after we found out the show, one of the questions we asked was, what was the network on which that show first appeared, or the network that created it, for want of a better word? And everybody that watched a Netflix original, association of that show with Netflix was close to 100%. And any of the licensed shows that we asked about, only about 40% of people actually knew what network that had originally come from. The other 60% gave us a wrong answer, or they just didn't know. And a lot of people thought that the show came from Netflix, for example, if that's where they watched it. So it really sort of underscored the double-edged sword of licensing a lot of your best shows to Netflix. There's a lot of revenue in that, but often, especially if it's a show that gains a lot of audience while it's on Netflix, the association and the promotion of your network brand can be stripped away that way. Personally, I think it's a good idea. When we see CBS, for example, keeping that, they were among the first to keep sort of their flagship brands like Star Trek for themselves and to put it on to their own streaming platform at the time rather than license it out to Netflix. They went without a lot of revenue there that they certainly could have gotten, but they recognized that that was a way that they couldn't afford to give away the crown jewels unless they wanted to become kind of a studio for Netflix, that they needed to have some of that real destination content to keep their brand first and foremost in people's mind and associate that brand with quality shows.
So one of the things that we've started to see happening is that the media companies are starting to pull back their content and load them into their own streaming properties, onto their own networks. Should we expect to see that trend continue?
I think so. And we're seeing a lot more of that lately. The two really big examples, of course, are Disney Plus and HBO Max. And in their case, it's not only that they're no longer licensing content to Netflix, but they're even taking content and putting it on streaming rather than putting it in movie theaters, for instance. And they haven't deserted movie theaters completely, for sure. But HBO Max, just as an example, taking all of the 2021 movies and putting them on streaming the same day that they're launched in theaters is a big risk for them. And it's a big disruption to the familiar and very profitable business model. But they recognize that in this environment where there's so many streaming platforms to choose from, and they all have their own original or exclusive content now, that there really needs to be some kind of destination to draw people to one over the other, something that makes it look distinctive or different. And at least in our research, it looks like that bet has really paid off for HBO Max.
So you have providers making these big decisions to try to differentiate their platforms. You know, you've got Disney Plus announcing that there are going to be, I think it was 10 series around expanding the Star Wars universe.
Yep.
You've got HBO Max, as you just cited, doing same day releases to theaters and on streaming simultaneously. You've got Netflix upping their original content production budget by multiples. You've got all kinds of different big pieces moving around right now, trying to differentiate platforms and really use content as the big draw. A, is it financially sustainable? And B, is it working? Does it make sense for these providers to be basically fighting on the front lines of the content wars?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It doesn't seem to me like it's something that can be sustained forever. Some of those investments are bearing lots of fruit. But as you said, there's more and more providers. The amount of content being produced, and especially original content, exclusive content produced each year, keeps going up and up and up. And people are using more and more platforms. But the one thing that isn't growing that much is just the number of hours in a day available to watch TV. And that certainly was vastly expanded while we had this pandemic going on. But presumably, their time is going to start to be curtailed somewhat again. Math for what is a sustainable audience for a TV show is a lot different if it's a paid subscription platform as opposed to one that you're selling ads against. I think you're exactly right that there's a limit to how many shows can be consumed, and there's a diminishing return as you produce more and more shows above that level that they're going to really be challenged to gain traction. And the cost of even trying to market all those shows so someone knows about them, that's a whole other challenge in and of itself.
So now let's talk about peak TV and a proliferation of content, and people have lists longer than they have time to watch it all. let's talk about awareness versus understanding. I'm in the industry and I have a hard time citing which franchises reside where and which programs are available to view where and who's offering what new slate. And it's just overwhelming.
It is.
So are consumers choosing their, you know, now almost five stacked services that they want to watch and sticking with them? Or are consumers following content all over the place and seeking out the content they want and then switching providers to get access to that content?
There's a lot of switching in and out based on interest in particular shows. That's probably just more of an attribute of human behavior. So the same thing happened even when there was no streaming platforms. And HBO, for example, would see subscriptions jump up when The Sopranos came out, and they would drop off when The Sopranos was over. The big difference, of course, is that with most of these streaming platforms, there are no contractual agreements. So people can kind of jump in and jump out whenever they want. And we found that about 60% of people say that at least once they have signed up for a platform just to get access to a particular show. And probably about two-thirds of those people, I think, say that they keep the platform when that show runs out. But there are a lot of people who don't. So, you know, the downside of that is obvious. You've invested all of this money in this really expensive new show and went to all the effort to get an audience. And now to reacquire those people, presumably you have to do that. You have to hit that bullseye again. And that's why it's so important for these platforms to have other things that maybe weren't the reason that those people visited in the first place, but something else that gets them hooked once they're on the platform and gives them a reason to keep paying that money every month.
That dynamic of Netflix sort of being a staying point on people's lists, is that changing because now you have so many other large streamers with big libraries of content that viewers feel less loyalty to one and are more likely to shift?
I think there's definitely some of that. You know, we haven't seen people leaving Netflix, but they're also not the only game in town anymore. So Hulu, HBO Max, to a lesser extent, Disney Plus have the operable amount of content that a platform has. Is just, do they have more than I can use? Is there always something new I could find to watch on there that's at least somewhat interesting to me? And almost all of those platforms clear that bar. So I think for sure the one threat that Netflix faces now that it hasn't faced before is that they are no longer the only bottomless well of content out there. There are lots of others. And that's why they're putting so much into developing high profile destination new content that is going to draw people in and really occupy their attention. I mean, they're going to launch one new theatrical release movie every week within 2021, which is a pretty amazing amount of resources and creates a lot of ammunition to consume people's time with. So they're definitely feeling that need, I think, to give people more and more reasons to visit and stay.
I was really intrigued by looking at some of the awareness understanding statistics in the study, where when you just look at the biggest streamers, Netflix, Prime, Hulu, and Disney Plus are the four cited in your study. The awareness numbers are all remarkably high, 97% for Netflix, down to 94% for the other three. So very high awareness, even for those large streamers. You know, the familiarity numbers are significantly lower, only 75%. For Netflix, which, you know, kind of makes you wonder, do people really identify with what the body of content has to offer from any of these services?
Exactly. So the way we defined familiarity was a little bit different in this study than in some other studies we do or other companies do. And we defined it as you are familiar if you're confident that you could explain to somebody else what this platform offers and how it's different from the alternatives. So that's why, for example, we see Disney Plus. Everybody knows about Disney Plus. A huge number of people use Disney Plus, but even there, only about half of people said that they felt confident they could explain to somebody else how it's different from other providers. That's probably the biggest reason that I think things like what Disney Plus and HBO Max are doing going forward, where they're taking really high profile brands like Marvel or Star Wars that will only be available on Disney Plus and everybody knows what those brands are, or HBO Max, where they're taking these big release movies that normally you'd have to go to a theater to see and putting them on HBO Max for free at the same time. Those are all really compelling content, but even more than that, they're a point of differentiation between those providers and all the other ones that are out there.
I was shocked at the Disney Plus number of 55% familiarity. The Disney brand is one of the most valuable brands in the world. Very clearly defined brand identity in the minds of most consumers, and yet not a great familiarity number with what types of content they're offering on their streaming service. I find that really interesting.
Yeah. Bear in mind that we asked people this question this includes people that have Disney Plus, but also people that don't. I think everybody has some assumptions about the kinds of content that would be on Disney Plus. But if you assume that means kids content, for example, there's kids content available on lots of platforms. Most of these providers are kind of omnivorous when it comes to what sorts of shows or movies you can find. We've seen this in qualitative research, interviews and focus groups and things. When you ask people what makes one platform different than another, they're often sort of at a loss, even if it's a platform that they like, to tell someone who has Netflix or who has Hulu, why would they also need Disney Plus? What boxes does that check that the other ones don't? People maybe have a suspicion about that, but they're not really sure.
Well, that sort of comes back then to the point where if you then have a very well-established program that's high buzz, high desire, then that might attract people to your service or to stay with your service. A large name franchise like Marvel or one of those universes would certainly do it. Perhaps a really robust slate of movie offerings, but it does seem to reconnect back to the content and that people follow the content. So you can put a big marketing budget against building awareness, but it's the content that's really going to create the stickiness with subscribers.
Yep. And giving people an idea of what kind of content that they're going to find. One thing that some companies have done is to, by design, sort of not try to appeal to everybody, but to target a very specific type of viewer. So if we look at AMC, for example, has had success with platforms like Shudder, which creates not even just only horror films, but kind of a very specific sort of indie genre of horror movies. And there's people who really like that kind of content. And it's not a huge audience. It wouldn't be enough to sustain an entire platform the size of Disney Plus, for example. But for those people, if you offer up exactly what they're after, what they're interested in, you're going to get a lot of attention from them and you're going to get really high penetration among that audience. Epix has done the same thing by positioning themselves as the platform for movie lovers and having a really curated slate of movies that they offer that they say is cultivated for people with a very specific set of tastes when it comes to films. And they've been able to grow their streaming audience by leaps and bounds since they did that. It's never going to be as big as an HBO Max, but it's something that is very differentiated. And for people that are after that experience, they find it and want to allocate a lot more disposable time to that than they would to something that's catered with some kind of content for everybody in it.
There's a threshold of any number of services that subscribers are going to be willing to pay for. And the needle's been moving a little bit, but it's fascinating when you look at age and how age affects this. If you look at the younger segment, 16 to 34, and you ask them which services could you not live without or what are your top choices, they choose streaming services and mostly the bigger ones. But 35 plus, which I certainly wouldn't consider as old.
Yeah.
And this was really surprising to me. 35 plus basically named the traditional broadcast networks and Netflix and ESPN.
Yeah, and that's what we've usually seen. You know, when we first started asking this question, Netflix didn't appear in the mix. They've kind of worked their way up among, you know, obviously they're number one among younger people, but among folks in the older age bracket, they've worked their way into that group as well. But typically it's people that grew up watching regular linear TV and have a comfort level with cable and or broadcast networks and with watching on linear. And they're more likely to think about those networks as things that if they were starting to build a bundle from scratch, you know, which you can't do in real life, but if you could, a lot of those people would start with the big network brands that are familiar to them from childhood as the building blocks. For younger people, they have much more specialized tastes. If they were watching linear TV at all, they would not be the kind of people that sort of channel surf necessarily to see what's on. And they like the idea of being able to find something I want to watch and watch all of it at once. Young folks are among the most likely to binge view. So they're really kind of two different viewing experiences, and those viewing experiences that people like, which do tend to differ by age, draw them to some platforms over others.
So there's another interesting shift happening here. We had started to train people to lower their tolerance for ads because in the streaming space, it was ad free. And all of a sudden, the free with ads content becomes really appealing. When you think about Roku or Pluto or Tubi or Vudu, Crackle, some of the others, I have a really hard time differentiating those brands. Is there any trend happening in that space that you can speak to that would help us understand where they're headed?
Sure. Well, the first is that you're exactly right. We find that even though awareness of those is surprisingly high, people are even less familiar with what makes one different from another. The reason is, I think that so far people have thought about those more as kind of technology companies. And that for sure we see changing. Viacom is putting lots of resources into Pluto to differentiate their content. We're seeing more exclusive shows on some of those providers than there were before. And so all of that gives people a reason to try them out. On top of the reason they already had to try them out, which is that they don't cost anything. So people are still really curious about all the new content and providers that are out there. We have seen in our research, and we can deduce by the increase we see in the number of users that the free with ads platforms are getting, that people really are at that threshold of how many different providers they want to pay for. That makes the prospect of watching TV, even if you have to watch some ads with it, a lot more appealing. If you ask people in general, if everything else was equal, would you rather pay for a subscription or watch for free and see some ads? They, by a pretty strong majority, choose the ad-supported model. It's the ad experience that they don't like. So they don't want to see the ad loads of live TV, or no difference in topic based on the kind of person you are. Everybody sees the same brands or products advertised. They don't want that experience. But with a lot of the things that you can do on ad-supported TV on the internet now, like limited ad loads, or like showing people timers, or like letting them pick a product category before they see the ads, all of those things go a long way towards making advertising a lot more tolerable.
Are there standout brands in the space, either ad supported or not, that consumers assume provide the best content? Do any of these providers have a sterling reputation with consumers?
Yeah, so there's really things that we see happening, but probably the most interesting one is that, especially among young people, the streaming providers rise to the top. And Netflix especially now, they're still the largest number of people who say that Netflix creates really good, really distinctive originals. And that's even among people who don't necessarily watch a lot of shows on Netflix. So some of these shows kind of create a halo effect that make people assume that other shows are going to be better. And really, that was their goal from the beginning. If we think back to House of Cards, a lot of folks in the industry were sort of blown away by how much money they spent on that. And there was a lot of work done to try to figure out if they got enough of an audience for that show to have made it worth it. And a lot of people concluded that they didn't, you know, but what that missed was that their goal was not just to get people to watch House of Cards. It was to get people to think about Netflix instead of it being a website that distributes shows other people made. To make people think about Netflix as a company that creates really compelling TV. So I think there's a lot to be said for, as you were saying earlier, it makes those really high profile shows more important than ever, because those are really defining the brand that produces them. And it's another reason why the networks can't afford, I think, to take those really high quality shows and license them out to someone else.
All of this movement is so fascinating. And I'm really intrigued by the way the consumer behavior is now driving the business strategy. Discovery, for example, has launched Discovery Plus, which is now really big, very fast, and has impressed a lot of people with the way the launch went. But it's a bit of a melting pot of content. It's everything from what the traditional Discovery universe would have been recognized for to what the traditional HGTV universe would have been known for.
Yep.
And there are very different audiences who are attracted to those different types of program. How do you see that playing out with consumers when there's services offering a lot, but it may not be a lot that that one viewer is really interested in consuming? And how does that play against the Netflix, a whole lot of stuff, but not quite as niche in what it is?
I can't speak to Discovery Plus specifically, but awareness is no longer enough to win an audience. There has to be something distinctive, or people have to understand why they would want to have your provider and instead of a different one. And since there's already more content out there than the average person can watch, including the content that's on the platforms they're already using, a lot of times the thing that makes a new one distinctive isn't the stuff that it has, but it's all the stuff that it doesn't have. And so when we ask people about, you know, we ask similar questions to the ones we've been talking about, but for network brands, people have a high understanding of and a high affinity for, assuming it's a category they're interested in, for brands where the network brand stands for a very specific kind of content that you can get your brain around. So ESPN is an obvious one, but also PBS or HGTV or the Food Network. As far as branding goes, those all have a really big advantage because no one is under any illusions of what might be in there. The understanding of those brands would be really, really high because it's really clear what's in each one. And Disney Plus is one, I think, that's done a pretty good job of aggregating their brands together, but not in a way that loses the impact of the individual ones. So I think for sure a big challenge that all these companies have is how to message their content to people in a way that people feel like there's a usable volume there, but they also have a clear idea of what kinds of shows they're going to find and what are the things that they know they won't find there. They can kind of rule that out.
It's really starting to feel to me like we're entering that next generation marketing phase where the way you position your service and message your content to consumers will matter in the choices and decisions and behavior that they then exhibit.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, especially if you know, we just had a study that came out this week, our connected home study, and 50% of people in the survey now have a smart TV with either a Roku or an Amazon in it. So by far the lion's share of smart TVs. And that means that people are using that smart TV interface as the mode to navigate through all this content. They might go from app to app, but they might just type in the name of a show and sort of jump over the app messaging entirely and find it that way. And in many cases, people are signing up for providers through the smart TV. So the only way that they ever see it is whatever the description is that appears in the app store on the TV set. So there's a really limited window to kind of communicate to people, you know, what this platform does and why they should want it. How is it different from all the other ones that are out there too? So it's really important to have some kind of messaging that can get through to people in a really short, succinct, compelling way.
When you talk to people about their preferences and why they like one provider over another, or what they gravitate to, or what their top five picks would be, and you start to drill down and say why, how much of the user experience, the interface, the recommendation engines, the curation aspect, how much does that come into play in all of this?
It definitely matters a lot. And often the frustration that people talk about, the hassle, if there is one, is using three or four or five different apps. And the design of each one is great in its own way, but none of them work quite the same way. And you have to go into two or three or four separate apps to decide what you're going to watch next. And so the thing that we hear people talk about the most, the thing that they value the most, is some kind of an aggregator that lets them see everything that they have to choose from, be it on streaming or be it on regular TV, but lets them discover, choose, and watch something all from a one-stop shop. And that's really what's behind the success of things like Amazon Channels. It's what's behind the success of Roku. And it's what's behind the success that, at least in our research, a lot of cable providers are having by integrating streaming apps into the video on demand. Just within the cable industry, for example, we find that the majority of people who integrate Netflix into their video on demand results, for instance, then use their cable remote to watch Netflix most or all of the time thereafter. So however good Netflix interface is, it doesn't beat out the convenience of not having to switch remotes and not having to switch inputs when I want something to see. And that's why I think being part of some of these aggregation platforms is so important for these individual providers. It's a way for them to get in front of more people.
So that really raises the bar on the competition aspect as well. You have to be paying attention not just to your content, but to the ease, convenience, and resonance of your content with the viewer experience.
Yeah, you know, it really raises the stakes of things. We saw the battle that HBO Max went through with Roku, for instance, and there are lots of good reasons that HBO Max would want to hold the steering wheel with the data on their viewers. But even for a platform as big as that one, it's a big risk not to be in the clearinghouse where people are watching all of their other shows from. But as we've been talking about over this whole conversation, it's really hard to get people to choose one platform over another if you're also asking them to choose a different device over the one that they're used to using because you're not available on that one. That's an exponentially harder sell to make.
This is a fascinating conversation. I could ask you 50 more questions, but I'll leave with one more, which is you've got this tremendous landscape view from behind the curtain. So what do you think we should all be keeping an eye on, doing, learning to be ready to give consumers what they're going to want next? How do we get in front of this to make the most of the opportunities at hand?
I think the biggest thing, and especially in the world of cable, is to just remember how important it is to start from the standpoint of what the consumer wants to do. So their consumers have choices now, and the tolerance they have for any amount of resistance in the process of finding something they want to watch and watching it is essentially zero. There's more content than they could ever hope to consume. There's lots of providers that rely on concurrent streams rather than the location of where they're logged in from, for example, so that there's not a lot of resistance to sharing the accounts with a certain amount of people. I think that the most successful providers in the future are going to be the ones who, no matter what, they always err on the side of being easier for people to use. And they try never to be in a position where they're an adversary of their customer. And that's just the standard that people are used to from streaming providers, but also how almost everything else works on the internet. And I think that's an area where cable companies especially will have a lot more success in the future, bearing that in mind, and it will make it a lot easier for them to leverage all the natural advantages they have. There's really only two or three companies that can aggregate video from lots of different sources, and there's only two, the cable company and Amazon, that can aggregate your video together with things that have nothing to do with video. So Amazon can give you video and your sneakers and your paper towels. The cable company can give you your phone and your internet and your video and your connected home capabilities. And I think all of that aggregation is going to become maybe the most important thing that defines the winners from the losers in the future, especially if all of that is done in a way that's really user-friendly for consumers.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And I know our listeners are going to just learn a ton from the conversation. Thank you so much for being generous with your time and your experience and insights. And maybe it's a conversation that needs to be continued.
Sounds good. I'll be here.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you.
Hope you found this Thinking Out Loud conversation interesting and perhaps even thought-provoking. There are more on the way. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review.